Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. This is the day we talk about key papers and presentations over the past year and about biliary cancers. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Ghassan Abou-Alpha from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, and Dr. Richard Finn from the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA in Los Angeles, California. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by our faculty, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As always, I have a very brief pre- and post-meeting survey. If you take that survey, we'll get learn a little bit about you, and you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. If you're into audio programs, we know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars in their cars or when they're driving around. Check out our program with Professor Arndt Vogel on the management of HCC. We do webinars all the time. On May the 17th, we'll be working with Joyce O'Shaughnessy, talking about HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. Then Dr. Michael Overman from MD Anderson will talk about colorectal cancer on May 18th. On the 23rd, we'll be doing a program on soft tissue sarcomas, related connective tissue disorders. Haven't touched on that topic lately. Really looking forward to it. And then, of course, our annual visit to ASCO in June or the Hilton Hotel. We're doing, I think, 10 seminars. Check these out. They're also going to be put out live online. But today we're here to talk about hepatobiliary cancers and particularly what's happened over the past year. We do at all of our year in review programs, I meet separately with each faculty member to record a presentation and discussion about the presentation, covering a lot of papers. There are links to that in the chat room, and we'll also send that out again when we send out the link to this webinar. So for a comprehensive review of all the papers we're talking about, check out these two presentations. But then what we like to do is then sit down with the faculty and pick out some of the most interesting presentations and topics and get the other faculty person's take, talk a little bit about clinical implication. But here are all the papers that Ghassan talked about. We're just going to, again, sort of review the top line. Same thing with Rich's papers on biliary tract. So we're going to spend our time really talking about the papers there. But I just got to tell a little story before we get started. This is not a hepatobiliary, but it's just, I don't know, something happened to me last week that I just want to share. I was telling Rich about it before you got here, Ghassan. So, you know, three or four times a year, we get into the situation where we're doing a whole bunch of things. Like, one is the ONS meeting, Oncology Nursing Society. So we went there last week. We actually amazingly did 10 programs in like 4 days. It was like really crazy and wild. And then we went to AUA in Chicago. That was in San Antonio. We did 2 meetings there. And, you know, I'm still kind of almost recovering from this crazy experience. But there was something that happened last Saturday that I keep thinking about. And it happened at the AUA meeting. And, you know, our audience today is mainly general medical oncologists. And all I can say is there's a paper called the EMBARK study, a phase 3 study in M0 prostate cancer. We'll talk about it. We're doing an ASCO meeting on Saturday night, June the 3rd, on prostate. So we'll talk about it there. But I was completely blown away by this study. That's all I can say. I think this study, from a quality of life point of view, is amazing, what they saw. I think general medical oncologists are going to see it differently than the urologists did, because we did a whole program there, and the urologists didn't realize what we were interested in. And I'm just going to summarize it by saying, and Rich, you know, you have also a very heavy background. You see breast cancer patients. I'm going to say I'm wondering, once people really take a good look at this study, whether they're going to conclude that enzalutamide maybe is going to be the new tamoxifen. To be continued, I just can't get it out of my head. But it also brings in the issue of the way general medical oncologists see data. And I think that's actually relevant to some of the things we're going to talk about. So I just want to put it out there that it's in my mind a lot right now. EMBARK. All right. HCC, and, you know, if you want to see what it's like to be a general medical oncologist and, you know, so many approvals and new papers coming out, between the time that I met with Ghassan, which was just a couple of weeks ago, and now, there was actually a very important paper presented. It was at the AACR meeting. All we had at that point, Ghassan, was the press release, and you and I talked about it, but now we saw the data. Bottom line, positive adjuvant study of atezo-bev. And we're just going to comment on it. Also, Ghassan, during his talk, talked about the update to the BCLC algorithm. I want to bring that up as well, because now there's a paper that just got published. I'm curious how that fits in. And finally, I just want to ask you about another paper related to antibiotics and IOs. But here's the IMbrave 050, adjuvant atezo in patients who've been resected or ablated. Of course, they're not going to look at transplant because the IO and transplant doesn't work. I guess one thing that was interesting, Rich, maybe you want to comment on it, that they brought out in the presentation that I wasn't aware of, was the so-called bimodal distribution of recurrence, although I don't know how much that second one is recurrence or new primaries. But any comment on that, Rich?
Yeah, you know, liver cancer is developing in a pre-malignant organ. The whole liver should be considered pre-malignant because it's been exposed to some insult, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, alcohol, etc. And we know that for the patients who are resected, that we can see recurrences, and this is somewhat arbitrary. We say within the first 2 years that this is probably a recurrence of the tumor that was resected, and there was micrometastatic disease within the liver. But then there's a group of patients who recur years later. And it's those patients who we sense are just de novo new metastatic, de novo new cancers. And that is why transplant is an attractive approach for patients who can't have resection, because it takes out the bad soil.
So, Ghassan, just in the chat room, Dr. K.S. Kumar, who's from the Florida Cancer Specialist, I'm sure he was waiting for this so he could ask this question, says he just saw a patient, poorly differentiated HCC yesterday, 14 by 9 by 5 cm tumor that was resected, no mets. He wants to know, based on Empower 050, he wants to give atezo-bev. He wants to know, how long does he wait to start the bev? The patient has no cirrhosis. Does she need EGD? So just keep that case in mind. And let's just take a quick look at the data. This is, I guess, part of their background where they talked about the recurrence over a period of time based on initial stage. But here's the bottom line. There was a DFS, RFS advantage, hazard rate 0.72. Kind of reminds me, we're talking about the first line Polarix trial, diffuse large B-cell, hazard rate, no survival data there. That got approved by the FDA, completely different cancer. But anyhow, survival at this point, you look at the subsets, I'm not sure there are enough patients there to really talk about whether etiology is any different. Everything seems to be mainly over to the left. Maybe you all can comment on that. Survival data immature at this point. So you've got RF relapse free survival with a, you know, pretty good hazard rate. You know, I've seen better, so to speak. So bottom line, Ghassan, first of all, is this something you want to do? Would you like to see the FDA approval? And what do you think about Dr. Kumar's patient?
No, thanks so much, Neil. If anything, point number one is no doubt, independent of the nitty-gritty details we're going to go through, this is, of course, good news for patients, because no doubt for the first time we're seeing at least a suggestion of some improvement in outcome based on a reduction in risk-free recurrence-free survival. On the other hand, very important point is, does the biology make sense to really use checkpoint inhibitors to prevent cancer from recurrence? Interestingly, it does, which interestingly, we could not see with the tyrosine kinase inhibitor like sorafenib, and it failed beforehand. But now for the first time, at least we have it just like something might be working in regard to the checkpoint inhibitors. Why is that? Because clearly the insult of the surgery does make a serious alteration in regard to the immune microenvironment, enough that a alteration of the lymphocyte neutrophil ratio will probably be there, and the such could be that the checkpoint inhibitor is coming to direct you in that regard. I add to this, of course, what Rich mentioned, which is like, you know, it's a pre-cancer to begin with. So there's no doubt this kind of, you know, adjuvant therapy that we're doing is not necessarily only handling what could be erupted from the tumor resection, but could be what's already there to begin with. And as such, all in all, biologically does make sense. However, when we look at the data, and to be fair, this is the two messages that we have, Dr. Omar. So number one is, this is only an abstract format so far. And already I had the chance to talk with actually Dr. Chow Pierce, and we chatted about the data. And to be fair, this needs to really come up to the final manuscript. So really exactly know the details, as we just, you know, heard from you and from Rich in regard to that double recurrence pattern. As you said, the immaturity of the full data in regard to the recurrence, even though the suggestion, if we look at the Kaplan-Meier curve and we are only basically trained in how to look at Kaplan-Meier curves, look good. We can insert fingers between the two arms, so why not? But we have to wait for the final data. And on top of that, of course, we need the approval. Yes, the drugs are available, but we really have to make sure that we see the FDA looking into that data from perspective of, yes, it does make sense or does not make sense. So I would say, yes, what we are seeing so far is appropriately okay, but we probably have to wait for a little bit more information before to move on to make it that standard of care. With that consist, in regard to the endoscopies, by all means, because remember, patients can be at risk, and no doubt that the endoscopy will be appropriate. What is the timing for that? As usual, it's got to be probably within the month or so, and we'll look into the information of the study details once we see it.
Rich, what's your take? Is this a therapy you want to use? I think you told me you're trying to use it on somebody. I don't know if you can access it. Interesting that, you know, the control arm by 18 months, they've got a lot, like more than 50% recurrence. So it's not a great prognostic situation. Is this something you want to do, Rich?
Yeah, for sure. Especially for someone who meets the trial entry criteria. I had a patient, poorly differentiated 8-centimeter tumor. He was very motivated to try this. And Dr. Kumar's patient, you could even argue that patient could have gotten atezobev up front, a large tumor, you know, borderline BCLC B or C, and this will relate to the new classification or the new comments on the Barcelona system. But a large tumor like that in a symptomatic patient, the odds of them being cured with surgery alone is very low. And I think I would give them every benefit of the doubt based on the data we've seen from the 050 study to give them the option of getting the regimen. And the study did require endoscopies, so that should be done.
So, Ghassan, you talked in your presentation about the BCLC revision. I guess this is the first revision since 2018. This paper is like, you know, 30 pages long. It's got a ton of stuff. Just this diagram itself, I can't even begin to understand. You go into a lot of that in your talk, but, you know, they were talking about all the things that happened since 2018, and here it is now. An adjuvant study came on after they published the papers, and now they maybe got to revise it again. But anyhow, any way you could translate this for somebody who doesn't want to read all 25 pages of this thing, Ghassan?
Absolutely. So in brief, the BCLC is a very interesting system that really dates back for quite a while, for almost more than 20 years. That stands after the B Barcelona Cancer of the Liver Clinic, which is a clinic that really takes care of liver cancer. And we give a lot of credit for Dr. Jordi Bruges, who really started all of that effort beforehand. The aim of it was to try to stage the patients based on the extent of cancer, but at the same time, because of the simplicity of the process at that time, because of the sadly not that many therapies available, it also offered, what do you do? It became like a manual. You have this, you do that. You have that, you do this. And that's pretty much what the BCLC was about. Historically, always there was a statement, which is quite fascinating, that the BCLC does extremely well to the extreme left, i.e. on the left of the screen, you can see the early stage disease. You see all those kind of, you know, arrows and details and what have we. This is always what you say. The BCLC does very well on the left, but does very poorly on the right. Now, as time evolved and as more therapies have been really brought in into the advanced disease, which what Rich and I have been heavily involved in and many other colleagues, and at the same time, a better understanding of the intermediate stage, interestingly, things start evolving to more details in regard to the intermediate stage and in regard to the advanced stage. As such, there are a lot of notions that brought in, and already Rich brought up one of them. He said, like, met Dr. Kumar's patients, like, did really have to have surgery? And as such, we're now reading things a little bit in more details. What are we dealing with? To give an example, and this only on this, in between parentheses to explain the BCLC, Dr. Kudo from Japan made an argument that he said based on number of lesions in the liver, size of the largest lesion in the liver, and these are two numbers that's straightforward to do, 4 centimeter largest lesion, 4, plus 4 number of lesions, let's say 4 plus 4 equals 8. He said any number more than 7, local therapy does not work. It should be systemic therapy. As such, it's very nice, Dr. Rieck. She did an incredible job. I really am very fascinated with that data because it really, for the first time, if we go back to see it, you'll see that there are three prongs that falling onto from the intermediate stage, and one of them entry direct intermediate stage all the way to advanced therapy. So that's really the notion of understanding the disease better from how much it's really implicated in regard to where does it stand, what does it imply in regard to recurrence, et cetera. As such, are we trying to say this is a way we steal patients from each other, like, you know, for local therapy, systemic therapy? Absolutely not. It's an invitation for us to make sure that we always look on tumor boards. Multidisciplinary team approach is a critical component for ACC. Everybody got to be on the table. And here, because we are only talking mainly to our colleagues in oncology, sadly, we have seen over time, and we've been really floating all around doing this for the last more than 2 decades, sadly, medical oncologists are the least people to go to the tumor boards. Please be there. Because otherwise, guess what? Our colleagues don't know what you're doing in regard to atezo-bev and durva-tremi and what have we. And you know what they're going to offer? They're going to offer hospice care. So that's why it's very important for us to be there.
Well, the other thing that they're going to offer is intrahepatic therapy. And I hear oncologists saying, you know, maybe, Rich, so much intrahepatic therapy by the time they see the patient, their patient has very poor liver function. And, you know, thinking again about the guidelines that have been out there, you know, before we started to see IOs, we didn't really see responses. Now we have atezo-bev, durvalumab, tremi, where you see responses. Rich, is it your take that maybe we're using systemic therapy earlier now and intrahepatic directed therapy a little bit less often or not really because, like Ghassan says, the oncologists aren't at the tumor boards?
I think that's definitely very correct, that oncologists do need to take a bigger role in the decision-making early on because we do have many more options. Even before immunotherapy, we had sequential TKIs and ramucirumab, and that's only been more important now that we have IO, which is markedly changing the natural history. And that is the new rendition of the BCLC that I think is relevant, is that it recognizes that some patients with intermediate disease might be better off with systemic treatment than local regional treatment. And if a patient only sees one specialist, they're going to get an opinion based on that one specialist. And it really behooves us to work together as a team, as Ghassan highlighted. And the other thing about the BCLC is patients are moving. Some patients are intermediate. They have a great response to local regional treatment or potentially even immunotherapy, and maybe they'll be resection candidates in the future. It's not a one-way street, and the new iteration of the BCLC recognizes that staging can be somewhat fluid.
Well, another thought, Ghassan, would be instead of either intrahepatic or systemic, how about both? And actually, Hassan in the chat room is curious about I guess a study looking at TACE and SBRT followed by avelumab with a high, I don't know this paper, but anyhow, high CR rate, 43%. What about this idea of sort of combining, particularly SBRT? You know, we have this great study in non-small cell lung where they used IO, durvalumab, after chemo radiation. So nobody knows for sure how much, you know, synergy was there. Any thoughts about synergy between like TACE, SBRT, and IO, Ghassan?
This is a very important point, and thanks so much for Dr. Hassan for that. If anything, historically, the advent of use of radiation therapy to the liver was really not it was a no-no, simply because we're worried about the liver. We don't like fry livers with radiation. But with the advent of more advanced approaches in regard to radiation therapy, now it is very safe and definitely can be very effective. If anything here, we should give credit, because this really who really started all of that effort is Dr. Laura Dawson from Princess Margaret in Toronto. And I proudly am humbled to say that when I was chair of the task force, I really helped Laura to lead into her study, the NRG R2OG 1112, that looked into the stereotactic bed radiation therapy, or SBRT. That's what SBRT stands for, stereotactic bed radiation therapy, plus sorafenib versus sorafenib in patients with HCC. And this study was presented, if many of us recall, at GI ASCO. And we were delighted in a way. And there was a little bit of concern about really the outcome per se that probably need to be a little bit further tuned to really understand better if, number one, are these really the right combinations or should we think about something else? Interestingly, the advent of the checkpoint inhibitors come into play for regard to the SBRT plus checkpoint inhibitors. And this is something that definitely is of interest. I can say that here at Memorial, we have a lot of lead effort in regard to that with Chris Crane and Clara Hage. And we kind of like hope that we'll see more of an outcome in that regard. Now, can we have variation of the SBRT like yttrium 90 radioembolization? I would say that this is a little bit of two schools of thought between the radiation oncologist and the interventional radiologist colleagues in regard, is SBRT and yttrium 90 to be compared? I think probably, frankly, and the best I can really count on what we heard all the time from our colleague, Dr. Riad Salem, who is really the expert in regard to radioembolization, they are different. And the radioembolization has a little bit of a more kind of, you know, a broad perspective that really what Rich talked about a second, it's an affected liver to begin with. It's really a precancerous component that the SBRT can really play a role quite a bit with. However, to be fair, we need randomized studies. These are not going to be anymore like the old days. The way TACE and the way the radioembolization, the way even the bland chemoembolization are approved based on kind of, you know, the 510 approach, which is not a randomized study. I think randomized study is critical because otherwise we'll not be able to move forward of systemic therapy plus the local therapy.
So, and I heard that they somehow managed to get both of you in this webinar is all excited because, of course, the big question out there in HCC is IMbrave 150 versus Himalaya. You're the PIs of both of those studies. I think one thing is great that we have two really good options now, but I guess the question is which one and which situation. I'll start with you, Rich. How are you looking at it?
Briefly, you know, I think there's some important differences between both studies to keep in mind. Very important is IMbrave 150 took a very high-risk population, including patients who had main portal vein invasion. These are patients whose prognosis is very poor and are largely been excluded to many of the modern studies. The lenvatinib-based studies and durvatremi excluded these high-risk patients. Despite having these high-risk patients, IMbrave 150 gave a significant improvement in overall survival. We know now that the hazard ratio is 0.59 and the survival for the entire population is over 19 months. There's no study, including high-risk patients like that, that is globally done that has that data set. Also, objective responses, 30%, very durable, and a safety profile that, you know, is really toxicity related to bevacizumab. That is hypertension, proteinuria, and bleeding events, which are generally low-grade. I would say that the first choice for me for a patient would be atezo-bev unless they have a contraindication. Contraindication to IO takes IO off the table regardless of the regimen. I think that's uncommon. Patients who are going to get bevacizumab for advanced liver cancer need an upper endoscopy within 3 months. And if they have high risk features, varices that can't be managed or recent bleeding, then you know, atezo-bev won't be a good option for them. But in reality, I think that's really, you know, 15% or less of liver cancer patients who are candidates for systemic treatment won't qualify for atezo-bev. And there's now real-world data from Dr. Pinato's group that reinforces this idea.
So I was just flashing on the fact that actually we got both of you on a satellite CME meeting like 3 hours after Ghassan presented the Himalaya data. I guess that was ASCO GI February 2000, about a year or so ago. So I heard similar thoughts from you at that point. Ghassan, you also at that point verbalized a lot of interest in the Himalaya approach. Now that we have both options out there, how are you deciding between two? Are you giving everybody Himalaya or what are you doing?
So first for our colleagues and audience, don't worry. Rich and I are very close friends. You won't believe how close we are. So that's really just to make sure before. But here we're really defending points. Number one is And I recall very well when you asked me, this was in January 2021, and you asked me specifically whom should you give the Durva-Tremi or the STRIDE or what the Himalaya study is about. And I said to everybody, as simple as that. And this is my argument for that. Number one, to be fair for Rich, there's always what's called first comer. And the first comer has an advantage. And by all means, we all heard and learned about the Atezolizumab. Exciting data, not to discredit in any way. This is incredible. For the first time, remember, we're talking about like medius rare 3 months, and now we're talking about like 19 months. This is like unheard of. So this was a big deal. On the other hand, interestingly enough, that when it came out, the number became kind of clinking to all of our minds, 19. Interesting enough that you can really walk on the street at ASCO, GI ASCO, and people on the street say, you say HCC, they will answer Atezolizumab. That's all what it does. And to be fair, there's nothing wrong with that. However, to be fair, as I always say, with every study that we have a positive answer, it brings with it many questions. And the first one is already what Rich mentioned. And please, this is more of a statement rather than anything else. And I'm really seconding what Dr. Finn said here. Please, if you decide and you're really insistent to do Atezolizumab, make sure you scope the patients. It's very sad, and unfortunately, it's appalling. It's really upsetting to see that patients have bled because they were not scoped after giving bevacizumab. And as we know from the study that was done by our colleague Abby Siegel a long time ago about bevacizumab on its own, people died. So there's no question that endoscopy is critical, as we just heard from Rich. The second point, though, that I would like to bring is, which is referring to what the population is dealing with, because always when a person tells me the mean survival X, I say, who are the patients? Because demographic of the study will matter quite a bit. And one thing that we can look at, and this is the data that we have, that in the Atezolizumab, 50% of the study was actually hepatitis B. On the other hand, in the Himalaya, 30% were hepatitis B. The Himalaya was generally way broader in regard to global presence, while the Atezolizumab and the AMREV 150 was a little bit more Asia present. Interestingly, then here we go. We hear from our colleague Pinto, and Rich just mentioned him, and with his very bright young colleague, her name is Dr. Fulginzi, and they bring in and say, we did a real-world data on Atezolizumab. It was called the AB Real Study, and the median survival was 15.7 months. Whoa, where's the 19? Where did it go? Interestingly, less Hep B, more Hep C, more NASH. And we know very well nowadays, this is, by the way, across the board for all the studies, the Hep B will always fare better than the Hep C. That will always fare better than the non-viral in regard to any checkpoint inhibitor. It does not mean we don't give it for the non-viral. We give it to everybody, but the expectation that the patient with Hep B will probably fare the best. As such, if you redo the Himalaya and let's say only Hep B, we're going to get a higher number. And we saw that number, by the way, not that long ago in the regard to the study that was presented at ESMO, which was looking into the Camrelizumab plus Rivaroxaban, which is another combination of anti-PD-L1 plus anti-VEGF. And guess what the median survival was? 22.1 months. And guess what? The study was 100% done in China. So where does patient have? Hep B. So that's really important to really look at the specific demographic of the patient that will give you a reading in regard to that. The last point I would like to bring up regard to the Atezolizumab, and to be fair, this is an important point. We don't know yet what's importance, and probably I'm softening a little bit about that because I'm not really seeing yet what it implies in regard to the final outcome. But so it's really kind of like a little bit concerning that the FDA itself brought in the issue of the anti-drug antibody, and they said 30% of the patient, which by the way, I give credit to Rich and his team. They reported that at the ACR, where 30% of the patients will have an antibody against Atezolizumab, and interestingly, the hazard ratio will turn from the efficient 0.5 or so all the way to 0.97 equal to sorafenib. While interestingly, durvalumab has only 1.5% of anti-drug antibody potential. So I think there are some issues in regard to the Atezolizumab that time will tell more of. But if you ask me, like my final answer, I think Atezolizumab, durvatremi, or also this new combination that we heard about the camrelizumab plus rivaroxaban, I think probably they're all equal after all.
So we could talk about this a long time, but just one other point I'm curious about, Rich, and you can see that Ghassan talked about a couple of papers looking at IO plus TKI, you know, so not Bev, but VEGF through TKI, one with cabozantinib, another the lenvatinib-pembro leap approach, and it kind of didn't seem like you saw, I mean, again, it's hard to do cross-trial comparison, as much efficacy with TKIs. And also, the lenvatinib arm was really at great outcomes in the LEAP study. Any thoughts about that, Rich?
Ghassan and I are very good friends, and we are two of the people who really have had an interest in liver cancer for 20 years and have seen it evolved. And just real quick, Ghassan, looking at IMbrave 150, actually the hepatitis C patients actually did the best in that study with a survival of 25 months. So I don't know how important etiology is, but it's also very relevant when we start looking at the new combinations. The LEAP 002 study looked very promising based on early data that lenvatinib and pembrolizumab had some synergy. And in reality, the phase 3 study recapitulated the single arm data very well. We had a survival of 22 months with len and pembro, a very high response rate. And this just goes to the point of how the natural history of liver cancer has changed. The control arm of lenvatinib in a double-blind placebo-controlled study. Keep in mind, most of the IO studies are open label. IO versus a TKI. But this study had a TKI in both arms, and lenvatinib had a survival of 19 months. Really impressive, showing the change in the natural history of HCC. But again, this study did not include patients with main portal vein. So that 19 months is not the same population as we saw with IMbrave 150. Cabozantinib and atezolizumab was also building on this idea that TKIs can modify the immune microenvironment, hitting unique kinases. And we know cabo is active in liver cancer. But while this study did meet its PFS endpoint, you see that here on the top, it did not meet an overall survival endpoint, a secondary endpoint. And also somewhat puzzling is the objective response rate with this combo was only 11%, less than what we see with single agent IO. And taken together, this regimen really did not move forward, you know, for FDA approval.
So before Ghassan starts, as I know we could go all day long, and I swore we're going to get through HCC halfway through, but we're not going to make it. But anyhow, Ghassan, one more point, and then we'll get to biliary tract. You also, we're talking about cabozantinib, and there were a couple of papers that sort of came out of the Celestial trial and, you know, second line after, sorafenib. One was, efficacy in patients with child PUB liver function, and another paper looking at quality of life. Can you comment on those papers, Ghassan, and also your clinical experience with these issues with cabozantinib?
Sure, by all means. Neil, again, thanks for bringing up the cabozantinib. And just in retrospect, many of us do remember before the advent of any checkpoint inhibitors, all of us were excited about the c-MET inhibition. And there were many c-MET inhibitors, among which cabozantinib. And cabozantinib, of course, is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It can address other things like AXL, VEGF, etc. And I recall, like, if you ask, like, what did I contribute to the study that we're very proud of and we published in the New England Journal of Medicine, interestingly, I kind of, you know, supported the sponsor on, as I said, bring it to everybody. Don't really choose the patients based on their c-MET expression. Just treat everybody. Because we don't know how much the role of the anti-VEGF, anti-AXL, anti-c-MET, etc. Treat everybody. And we're very proud the study came out positive. And really, it's a drug that's available not only in second line, but also in the third line. Actually, the only drug that's available in third line in HCC. Now, no doubt that our experience and our colleagues in the community physicians, which I totally agree with you, Neil, they are way ahead of us in understanding, and they have experience in regard to other diseases as well. They're not a big fan of cabozantinib because of adverse events in regard to other cancers. And as such, there's a little bit of hesitance in regard to the therapy. But I would say that the 60 milligram adjustment to 40 and possibly 20 is definitely less likely to happen. But interestingly, we tried to even dissect that further, and I give credit to our dear colleague, Dr. Antil Kouheri, who actually led on that effort, part of the cabozantinib study, that looked into the patients who really have a child PUB scoring, which has been worse worsening. And know that, that we can see that despite that, we can see that clearly still the patients will actually still benefit from the cabozantinib. Now, this is, I will take it with a little bit of a grain of salt, even though I was a senior author on it. But to be fair, this is really a population that, you know, the B7 is another thing story from compared to the B9. So we have to be very careful and thoughtful about really what does it mean in that regard per se. The second part that you brought in is the quality of life. And no question that the quality of our component is really important. And yes, despite that some of the hesitancy in regard to the cabozantinib, as I just mentioned, I would say still at the end of the day, patients can do well with it. So it's, is it worth the drug? By all means, it is.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about biliary tract cancers. And I think I was sharing with you, Rich, that I like to call biliary tract cancers the new non-small cell lung cancer because there's so many targetable lesions there. But one of the things you got into in the beginning of your talk, Rich, that maybe you can just sort of summarize a little bit, is sort of an overview of this disease, correlation between anatomy and biology, and what we're seeing in terms of potential targeted lesions.
Yeah, for a relatively rare malignancy, we are seeing more of it, and we are making some great strides in managing it, but there's still a lot of work to be done. Anatomically, we break these into intrahepatic tumors arising within the liver, the intrahepatic ducts. Then we talk about tumors that occur at the hilum, the so-called Klatskin-type tumor. And then there's the extrahepatic bile duct, which goes from the liver to the ampulla. And then there is also the gallbladder and gallbladder cancers. What do they share in common? Well, that biliary epithelium can be exposed to various insults that can give rise to tumors. And there's been excellent, excellent profiling work on these tumors, which has increased our understanding of the biology of this disease. And while there are actionable mutations, they tend to track with tumor location, which is a very interesting observation. And now that we have the molecular understanding of the disease, FGFR2 alterations, genomic translocations are now FDA-approved agents for that alteration. Gasson played a pivotal role in the approval of IDH inhibitors, ivosidenib. And more recently, we're seeing IO come to the front line. HER2 amplification's been around a long time, but occurs, you know, more frequently in some of the gallbladder cancers, which is a relatively rare subtype, and then a rare alteration. So, you know, there's challenges in developing high-level evidence for this disease, and certainly biomarker-driven studies have been, you know, challenging to accrue to, but really take a great effort.
All right. Well, we actually have a couple of things in the chat room that are kind of interesting. So Gasson, Emily has a patient with IDH2 mutated cholangio. What do you recommend second line after chemo IO? Hold off on the answer to that one. Just keep it in your mind. And now Dr. Kumar is back with another patient. He has a great practice. So he's got a patient with a 5x4x3.5 centimeter tumor resected that was read as a combined HCC and cholangio. And he says, is the prognosis determined by cholangio? Should I give chemo and durva based on TOPAZ and forget the HCC for now or treat the HCC? So those are a couple cases we can keep in mind. But first, let's get to the first line situation because this has changed recently, as we talked about. So first, you know, of course, we saw the TOPAZ study and looking at DURVA plus chemo, GEMCIS, which saw benefit. So that was great to have that option. I heard a lot of cases being presented to me of people getting treated that way. But then we just had another study, very similar to me. It looks very similar. Katie Kelly presented ACR, I think, and then published immediately in Lancet, Pembro with GEM and CIS. Kind of looks similar to me, like hazard rate about 0.8, 0.82. Gasson, what's your take? Is this like going to be a coin flip, and are you using this strategy? I mean, it's not the most amazing outcome, but it is positive.
No, by all means. If anything, congratulations to Katie. Quite impressive work and very delighted to see it as well. There is actually one little caveat of difference between the two studies, which probably kind of like probably played a role. Interestingly, in the first one, in regard to the durvalumab, the Topaz, the GEMSYS was stopped exactly at 6 months, same like the ABC02 study. And by the way, for our colleagues in the community, this is not really something that we like to decide. But interestingly, the UK, as you know, there's like a system where they really kind of like rank and kind of like value quality of life and life. And this is something that we don't talk about here in the US. And that's how they decide how much therapy you can give for a patient. How much really contribution can this do? And there was a decision in the ABC02 study of GEMSYS just stop at 6 months, regardless of what the patient outcome is. So the Topaz led to or was obligated to compare to the ABC02 study. So 6 months of GEMSYS only, and then after that, carry on with the durvalumab. In the new study, the Keynote 966, interestingly, after the 6 months, actually the gemcitabine carried on with the pembrolizumab. That's quite fascinating. And if anything, it really brings in a question, is this really what should happen afterwards? I'll talk about life clinical experience. We have noticed that proudly, by the way, with the GEMSYS Durva, have we seen CRs? Yes, we did. Actually, already I've saw it three times. But have we seen recurrence at some point after a CR? Yes, we have seen that as well. And interestingly, what we have done is to really re-trigger with the chemotherapy. And as such, an approach was similar a little bit more to the Keynote 966, i.e., you drop the cisplatin at 6 months, keep the gem, and continue with the Durva. Probably is a good idea after all, because remember, it's a cold tumor. It needs to be heated up by certain chemotherapy, and that's where the gem can play a role. But other than that, you're absolutely right, Neil. They are equal. It wouldn't matter. As long as you're giving chemotherapy plus some form of checkpoint inhibitors, you'll be okay, and you'll treat patients correctly.
So, Rich, what are your thoughts? And any thoughts about this case Dr. Kumar has? I heard about this combined thing where you can't tell which one it is. How do you approach a case like this, Rich?
Yeah, so I agree with everything Ghassan said. You know, in clinical practice, I have a lot more experience with Topaz. In clinical research, we were the lead U.S. accruer on Keynote 966, and so I have some experience with patients in that regard. And it certainly is the standard of care to introduce IO frontline. Personally, I continue chemo. If it's not broken, why fix it, right? If patients are doing well, they're tolerating it, they're having benefit, I tend to continue. Dr. Kumar has identified a real entity. We know that this mixed cholangiohepatocellular pathology does exist. Likely there is a common cell of origin that has a mixed differentiation. And this tends to be a worse prognosis than a pure HCC. In fact, so much so that mixed cholangiohepatocellular carcinomas cannot be eligible for transplant. In this setting, I would probably offer this patient capecitabine adjuvantly in the context of the BILCAP study to try to prevent the recurrence of this cholangio component. It'd be interesting to know why this patient developed this tumor. Do they have PSC? Do they have hepatitis C? But clearly, there's an abnormal biliary epithelium here, and I would offer them CAPE.
Okay, so Ghassan, the chat room's blowing up with great cases. Michelle, patient with deficient MMR cholangio. I love how this one starts. High TMB, stage 4, progressed on GEMSYS Durva. Would you give more immunotherapy second line, like ipi/nivo or something? MMR deficient.
That's a beautiful example. Yeah, no, that's a beautiful, beautiful question. Interestingly enough, the approach that we're taking in clinic, even though we are used to the idea that you just kind of, you know, have progression of disease, you consider that all therapies that you're giving are really not working and you change to some other therapy, which is exactly what the question is. Interestingly, the way you can approach the checkpoint inhibitors, and there's like some biologic argument for that, it's the scaffold of a building. And if anything, what you add on as chemotherapy, being like the GEMSYS or what have we, is like just slapping walls onto the scaffold of the building. And as such, if there's a progression, you can very much argue to keep the scaffold the same way, i.e. keep the checkpoint inhibitors, i.e. the durvalumab, and take off the walls and put new walls on with the new therapy. And we have done that before. And for example, moving on from the GEMSYS plus durvalumab to liposomal irinotecan 5 fluorouracil plus durvalumab, even followed to after that to FOLFOX plus durvalumab, is not like an unheard of component. And I would recommend personally, at least by experience, even though we need to prove for that, to keep the checkpoint inhibitors while continuing to change the therapy.
I love those analogy type things, the scaffolding, all that. I'm just flashing at ONS. I don't know if you know Rich Stone from Dana-Farber. He made the analogy between MDS and a factory where all the workers are drunk. The marrow is like a factory where all the workers are drunk. Anyhow.
I should ask about the CTLA-4 CD28 story they have.
All right. FGFR inhibitors. Actually, we talked about this in our bladder program in AUA, Rich, also. You know, erdafitinib approved, a big issue there. But here we have different FGFR inhibitors, and you went through that in your talk. Can you kind of provide an overview of these alterations, how often you see it, and where we are right now with FGFR inhibitors?
Yeah, it's a very exciting story. Because so long we were always focused on mutation, right? And that was the rationale for a lot of kinase inhibitors taking from the lung cancer experience, so to speak. But in the early studies with these inhibitors, it turned out that it was not point mutations, but genomic alterations where FGFR2 gene is typically translocated to another partner. And these translocations tend to occur within a certain frequency in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas more frequently. And it looks like my typical patient is a younger woman who has no underlying liver disease who presents with these alterations. And now these drugs have been shown to have significant response rates, 35 to 40% in this population, higher than chemotherapy, I would state, and are an important option. The challenge is, you know, like we see with many kinase inhibitors, patients eventually develop resistance. And we're still trying to sort out the role of newer FGFR2 inhibitors to see if we can overcome resistance to the first generation, so to speak. But this story highlights the importance of doing molecular profiling. And for that patient we just heard about, I largely do agree with Ghassan. I often try to keep IO ongoing if I'm combining it with chemo, insurance, you know, companies, approval required. But that patient should have molecular profiling because perhaps they do have one of these actionable mutations, such as FGFR2 translocations.
So, Ghassan, I'm kind of curious. You know, again, in lung cancer, when you see targeted therapy that has a response rate that's getting up to 50% or more, they just start using it first line. They don't do randomized studies anymore. They just give it first line. Any situations, you know, older patient, you don't want to give chemo to, et cetera, where you might want to use targeted therapy first, like FGFR inhibitors?
By all means, you bring a very important point, Neil. And to be fair, I think our colleagues in lung have done way better than us. But to be fair, not for a reason, but it's way easier to get a biopsy in the lung. It's a less complex in regard to the complexity of the biliary tree and the bilirubin elevation or what have we. Regardless of this, I totally agree with Rich. Very critical. I mean, my always joke is, as a patient coming to Memorial Sloan Kettering in the middle of Manhattan, they should be getting their next generation sequencing while walking in. Like, this is really how early it should be done, because this is very critical information they need later on in time. Now, the approach that we've been looking at is randomized study. You compare this to a standard of care. You compare a certain anti-FGFR2 to the chemotherapy standard of care, and you find out what's going on. In reality, we all got excited, but in reality, the FGFR2 fusion happening in the real world is about 5%. And as such, to really rare cancer to begin with, now you have only 5% of patients with that genetic alteration, and you're doing a randomized trial. Already we tried. It did not work. Actually, already the infigratinib is already pulled out even altogether. The company is not even pursuing it any further because it was like the ultimate failure. And this is where our obligation is to really have it sit in with the agency that maybe for those alterations, we don't need the randomized phase 3 clinical trials. And at the same time, could we treat patients with this approach because simply they are having the genetic alteration? Yes, we can. One, I give a good example of that is the BRAF V600E, which can happen in biliary cancer. And this is nice work that I give a lot of credit for Dr. Subia and Dr. Javli from MD Anderson. Beautiful work. And if anything, I was actually interviewed on at ESMO, and they said, would you give it in first line? I said, absolutely. This is no question about it. That this is really a great response. By all means, we should definitely apply it when we can. The problem is we don't have that data for the other genetic alteration. And that's why maybe a new approach in regard to the approval of those studies should be looked into rather than through the classic phase 3 clinical trial that we have been doing since 1960.
Well, as you say, they've got the precedent for sure, because that's what's happening in lung. Rich, what do we know about the currently available agents? What's the difference between them? And maybe comment a little bit on efficacy, but also tolerability, because this is a different class of agents with some interesting side effects. First, can you talk a little bit about what we know about pemigatinib?
Yeah, so pemigatinib is one of the first generation FGFR TKIs. It hits several of the FGFR family members. It was one of the first to be approved. It's dosed 2 weeks on and 1 week off, and it is irreversible, right? And we know some kinase inhibitors are reversible, some are irreversible, depending on their mechanism of engagement with the target. But needless to say, for these fusion patients, these translocated patients, the objective response rate was like 37% with a very durable for a kinase inhibitor around 9 months. And survival in a single arm cohort study was over 17 months. And this was second line. Now, FGFR has on-target effects. FGFRs are, these receptors are very important for regulating phosphate metabolism in the kidney, and therefore hyperphosphatemia has to be watched for. You know, these patients can develop hyperphosphatemia, and these patients need to be treated for that with a FOS binder, sometimes being recommended to be on a low FOS diet, but generally very manageable with those interventions. But then we have these unpredictable side effects, which, you know, when we give patients chemotherapy, we can say you're going to, you know, have alopecia, you're going to get nauseous, you're going to have cytopenias. But the kinase inhibitors can be somewhat unpredictable. And with these drugs, often we can see still alopecia, GI toxicity, and often a very uncomfortable dermatologic finding of these changes in the nails and the nail beds that can be very problematic for patients and affect their quality of life. I've had patients who've actually lost their nails from this inflammatory reaction. Now, there's a new FGFR inhibitor that was approved only in the past few weeks, earlier this year, and Lipika Goyal from Mass General, now at Stanford, had led this study of futibatinib. And unlike the other FGFR inhibitors that preceded it, this one is irreversible and it's dosed continuously. And in this study of FGFR2 fusion arranged patients, the objective response rate was just about 42%, in range of what we saw with pemigatinib, with a long duration of response and a very mature survival. Now, this drug, as they presented in the publication, does have a little different kinase profile. It hits some of the alterations that pemigatinib does not, some of the potential resistance mechanisms. But I think we're not in the state that we necessarily save this drug for later. I think at this point, for a patient who's progressing on frontline treatment, we now have currently approved two FGFR inhibitors for broad use, pemigatinib and futibatinib. And again, the side effect profile seems very similar to the other compound.
So, Ghassan, actually, the nurses at ONS, we were talking a lot about these FGFR and what they do with the nails and all that. But this is a new arena in oncology, some of these, particularly hyperphosphatemia. Anything you want to say about your own clinical experience with these agents and any sort of, I don't know, clinical pearls about how to utilize them, Ghassan?
Sure. By all means, I first concur and I 100% agree on all what Rich said in regard to the potential adverse events. And I will start by saying that that first step is to make sure that a patient should get a retinal exam, because if ophthalmology, retinal exam is critical to have as baseline. It's not going to be a decision maker one way or the other, but the potential for having or building subretinal fluid foci, which are typically of MAP kinase inhibitors as well, could be a potential adverse event. So you need a baseline to really compare to, in case the patient come to you with a little bit of a halo of not unclarity or darkening one side of the hearing, of the vision. Number two is you have the phosphate, and number three, of course, you have the skin, and of course, other two adverse events that could occur. Interestingly, what we learned over time, and we've been really heavily involved in regard to the infigratinib, pemigatinib, and Relay now, we really are noticing that maybe we're sometimes overreacting. We should be very careful how much we're going to treat things. Ironically, and probably this is like a little bit kind of, you know, a saddening fact, one of the side effects of the first study that we reported in infigratinib was actually hypophosphatemia. We actually treated patients way enough to make them hypophosphatemic rather than they were hypophosphatemic. So we have to be very careful how much we treat things. And it's not treating number, it's treating patients. It's very important to follow what Dr. Finn just mentioned, but we have to really put all measure within the context of what's going on for the patients. All in all, I think the experience is teaching us better. Yes, the finger and the fingernails can have the problem. If anything, is something to be aware and conscious of as well. We proudly have at Sloan Kettering, because who are really multidisciplinary in every approach. We probably already published with our colleagues in ophthalmology, Dr. Jasmine Francis, on the retinal alterations. And fascinating is that this is reversible. You stop the drug, it can recur and it can improve, and back you can restart the drug again. Number two, we're working with Marie Locouture in regard to the skin toxicity. And this is something that's evolving in dynamic way to really get some very detailed guidelines that will help people and same time make it practical for them to use the drug. All in all, good drugs, definitely not to be missed, and at the same time to really be cautious of the adverse events. One word, if you allow me, in regard to the differences between the two drugs or the many drugs that we have. There are a couple of schools of thought that are happening as we speak. On one hand, I'm really fascinated by the work that actually Dr. Goyal has brought in regard to tifibatinib. And at the irreversibility, there's the multi-targeting, which is FGFR 1, 2, 3, and 4. And you say, like, you know what, like going to war, the more weapons you have, the better it is. But interestingly, do we need that kind of, you know, diversity, or do we need more specificity? Because the Relay drug, which is not yet approved for that indication or any indication, interestingly enough, is highly specific. Specific for FGFR2. Do you want really a spread out weapons, or you want like a very highly targeted weapons? There's something to really think about a little bit more as we produce more productivity on that regard. And I give credit here for my colleague James Harding and also Alison Schramm or Alice Schramm that work on the Relay. Quite interesting to see how a highly specific and with an IC50, which is incredibly, incredibly efficient, is causing an improvement in regard to patients with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma.
So a couple of final points. Rich, you covered a couple of anti-HER therapies in biliary tract cancer. Of course, you've done lots of work with Dr. Slayman over the years on trastuzumab, HER2-positive breast cancer. We actually at ONS did a meeting where we talked about HER2 in breast, GI, and lung in the same conference. We had your colleague Zev Weinberg there, incidentally. So I don't know, you know, now we're looking at biliary tract, and you can see TDXD, which is what we were talking about mostly at ONS, looks like does cause responses, as it seems to in many other, I think, endometrial, they've seen it as well. But also this bispecific, the nickname is Zani, already has a nickname, Zanidatamab, a bispecific that it's not an immune bispecific, it's like a targeted bispecific. So, Rich, you cover these in your talk extensively, but any thoughts about anti-HER therapy? How often do you see, quote, HER2 positive, even HER2 low? And any thoughts about whether this is going to play out in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we are generally looking for genetic alterations in HER2 and bile duct cancers. So this idea of HER2 high and low, which is taken over the breast field, I don't think has come to play yet in biliary tract cancers. We're still looking to get a HER2 therapeutic FDA approved, even though some have NCCN listing. You know, FDA approval is what's really required to help push these things forward. Zanidatinib is a HER2 antibody that hits two different epitopes on HER2, kind of like using trastuzumab and pertuzumab together, and is showing very encouraging response rates. Again, 41% in a single-arm study. And these are patients who are amplified or high by immunohistochemistry. And really, there's no new safety signals in using this compound against HER2, a very clean side effect profile. And that goes to be said for trastuzumab deruxtecan, an antibody-drug conjugate that's really changed the way we treat HER2-positive cancers, breast and gastric potentially. And again, in patients who are HER2 amplified, 36% response rate, they did look at this HER2 low, and there was some responses. But really, I think moving forward with this compound for registration would be to concentrate on this HER2 amplified cohort. The challenge is it's relatively rare in mostly, you know, gallbladder cancers. And so hopefully we can maybe just expand the cohorts instead of having 20 patients, maybe a large 100-patient cohort or more would be a strategy to get approval, as been done with the FGFR2 inhibitors. But I think HER2-directed therapies are taking way too long to get to this indication. It's been known about for a long time. But, you know, biliary tract tumors are often an afterthought. I used to say that about liver cancer, HCC, but even more so with biliary tract tumors. But they're coming to prime time now. It's recognized as a large unmet need.
And in terms of Zani and HER2-positive breast cancer, which I'm sure the whole audience is thinking about, they have done a phase 1 study of Zani monotherapy in breasts, and they did see responses of a number of them. I think there were 20 patients, maybe a 36% response rate. Final comment. Another thing you covered in your talk, Rich, was seribantumab, the Crestone study, looking at NRG fusions, talking about uncommon, extremely uncommon, but you see efficacy there. Unfortunately, I guess the drug has been put on hold in terms of development for, I don't know, financial, not medical reason or research reason. It is an exciting agent. So hopefully they'll be able to figure out a way to keep studying it. But Rich, what's the bottom line in terms of, you know, this is very uncommon, difficult to do studies. And when they're so uncommon, it looks like it's pretty effective targeted therapy. Any comments, Rich?
Yeah, I mean, the cholangio cohort in this study was very small. They didn't report, you know, a lot of activity there specifically. But in the lung cancer group, this was an active drug. And what's interesting is when you have these neuregulin fusions, HER3 is a very important target for them. And this antibody is against HER3, a first in class, so to speak. But we'll have to wait to see more on that story.
So, Rich and Ghassan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back on May 17th. Have a couple cups of coffee before we start talking with Joyce O'Shaughnessy, because it's going to go fast, but be a lot of fun on May 17th. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Ghassan.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Rich.
Thanks for having us. Thank you, Neil. Thank you, everybody.